Okay, the Health and Human Services Committee will come to order. Cheryl, good to see you again. Will you please call the roll?
Chair Burton?
Here.
Representatives Altman?
Here.
Batana?
Here.
Brown? Buchanan?
Here.
Davis?
Here.
Duran?
Here.
Garrison?
Here.
Grant?
Here.
Coster?
Here.
Masullo?
Here.
Mello? Here. Persons Mullica?
Here.
Rayner?
Here.
Rizzo?
Here.
F. Robinson?
Here.
W. Robinson?
Here.
Saroy?
Here.
Skidmore?
Here.
Tant?
Here.
Yarbrough?
Here.
Quorum is present.
Thank you, Cheryl. Members, as always, as we start the meeting, I'm going to remind everybody to please turn your cell phones off. And since we actually have members of the public with us here today, visitors in the room, I'll send you that reminder as well. When you were watching us from home, that was up to you. Welcome and happy to see so many familiar faces back here in the committee room. You may have noticed we've got a couple of changes, and we have a couple of new members and a couple of also other of our members who have new leadership positions here in the committee. Representative Garrison was a member last session, but he now joins us in the capacity as the whip for the committee. So welcome and happy to have you with us, Representative. And also my longtime friend, Representative Tracy Davis, who's been on the committee as well. Representative Davis is now our ranking Democratic member. Congratulations and welcome, Representative Davis. Good to have you. And is Representative Brown here? Well, Representative Brown is coming. Representative Camilla Brown is now on our committee, so we'll be excited to have her with us, as well as Representative Buchanan, who I know, did I see Representative Buchanan? There he is all the way at the end. Welcome, and welcome to the committee, Representative. Thank you. Really happy to have you. So we have a presentation, or a couple of presentations. I believe you all saw that in your meeting notice, and I know everybody has the packets downloaded on their computers with them or in paper. We thought one of the things we would start talking about here in HHS are, you know, what innovations that provide, we think, great care for Floridians, our healthcare providers around the state, finding themselves utilizing more or perhaps a new. Many of these innovations coming out of the pandemic that we are still in the middle of, quite frankly, here in the state of Florida, things are looking better than they were even a few weeks ago. But we know that healthcare providers all over the state have found new and innovative ways to care for their patients. And I'm really happy that we could have representatives of two of those wonderful healthcare provider organizations with us today. We have Advent Health, Central Florida Division, as well as the Mayo Clinic representative in our presentations today. So I think to get things kicked off, we will begin with Dr. Neil Finkler, who is the Chief Clinical Officer at Advent Health, Central Florida Division. He's here to brief us on hospital care model innovations in particular. Welcome, Dr. Finkler. You are recognized for your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and I hope everybody could hear me.
Yes, sir.
Perfect. Thank you very much. It's really my pleasure, and it's a great opportunity to come and speak with you today with regards to our innovations. The innovations that we have seen throughout the pandemic. All right. So just as a reminder, just to set this as a framework. Back up here. I'm sorry, we're having just some technical problems. Just bear with us. Anyway, I will continue. I hope you all can still hear me. Just as a reminder, Advent Health is a national brand, and within the state of Florida, we have a representation across the I-4 corridor. Within the Central Florida Division, we have facilities represented in Flagler, Lake, Sumter, and Volusia counties, as well as Orange, Osceola, Polk, and Seminole counties, 17 facilities that you could see outlined on this slide. In addition, we have a West Florida division, where we have an additional 11 facilities located in Hardy, Highlands, Hillsborough, Marion, Pasco, and Pinellas County. Just as a reminder for the committee, Advent Health is a national brand, is the only healthcare facility who's headquartered in the state of Florida with its national headquarters at Altamont Springs.
Dr. Finkler, if you're having difficulty advancing your slides, if we can go to the, if you'll say next slide. Oh, there we go.
Okay, so great. Just next slide, please. I think we're doing better now here. I think it's functioning and it's listening better. So just to give the committee members an update as to where we are as of 9/14, as you had mentioned, we are past our peak. August 12th was the date of our peak of a little over 1,700 patients throughout the Central Florida Division, and that dropped to 891 on 9/14. As of this morning, those numbers continue to drop very precipitously, and within the Central Florida Division this morning, as of midnight, we were at 732 inpatients within Central Florida. And although that's a great decrease from where we've been, I just remind the committee members that if you look back in January of 2021, that was our previous peak of 829, and July of 2020, a previous peak of 836. So the current peak that we just witnessed was more than twice what we've previously seen, and we still remain higher than our previous peaks. Go to the next slide. This is the same as true in our West Florida division, where they peaked on 830 at 707 inpatients, and they're down to 508 inpatients on 914. And again, you could see the previous peaks, and this represents twice what they've previously seen. In both the West Florida as well as the Central Florida division, the total number of inpatients that you see represented between 40 and 45% of our total inpatient beds. So that should at least give a framework for the committee members with regards to the magnitude of what we have just been through and the magnitude of, quite frankly, what we continue to witness. As we look through COVID-19 and as we began to understand the challenges in front of us, we very quickly realized that in order to analyze the situation and predict the future, and particularly look for innovative ways of providing care, there were really three parameters that we wanted to evaluate on an ongoing basis. And that is really the space, the staffing, and the supplies. And when it comes to things like space, it's really where do we deliver care? With staffing, it's who is delivering the care, and it's supplies, what tools and resources do we have available? And I'll remind everybody that at the outset of COVID back in March of 2020, the big limiting factors that we had were supplies. We didn't have adequate supplies of N95 masks. We didn't have supplies, adequate supplies of similar respirators that we could use. And we were really limited also by our testing capabilities. So at the early onset of COVID, we really spent a lot of time thinking about supplies. Staff was always an issue because we had staffing concerns even prior to the pandemic, but the healthcare industry, like so many other industries, has certainly suffered with regards to staffing capabilities. And we've had to be very nimble and innovative with regards to how do we cover the patients. And then finally, space. At the outset of COVID, we really considered what would this look like if we completely got overrun as a hospital system? Would we set up field hospitals? Would we use some of the vacant hotels that had closed and shuttered during the early phases of COVID? Would we join forces with some of our community and our local government forces and use convention centers, government space? All these things were contemplated. And what I'd like to really now walk you through is some of the places where we have looked at space, staff, and supplies and really thought about innovation and give you some updates. So let's first talk about space. Again, it became very clear to us at the outset that if COVID got as bad as we thought it could be, that we could potentially have limited space left within our walls of our facilities. So where could we deliver care? And most importantly, we started to think of how do we deflect care out of our emergency rooms and out of our hospitals to reduce both emergency room visits as well as readmission rates. And there were two innovative solutions that we partnered with. One of them is a remote patient monitor through a company called Vivify. And the other is a partnership that we did with Dispatch Health that really provided home-based care. So since April 2020, with regards to remote patient monitoring, we were able to refer about 36,000 patients to remote patient monitoring through the Vivify platform. Patients were given thermometers as well as home oxygen sensors. These were monitored centrally. And if there were any alarming factors, we were able to do virtual visits or send a physician and or a caregiver out to the actual home and check up on the patient. And as a result, these numbers are as of about a week ago, the patients who completed the remote patient monitoring program had about half the number of emergency room visits as those COVID patients who didn't or declined the remote patient monitoring. And the same thing we saw with regards to inpatient readmission rates. Patients who completed this remote patient monitoring had about a third the rate of readmissions to the hospital. So again, we've seen great results with regards to our remote patient monitoring, with regards to being able to care for patients in a space that prior to COVID, we never considered. In addition, since April 2021, with our partnership with Dispatch Health, we have about 2,000 patients that we've been able to deflect and give home care through the partnership with Dispatch Health. This has also been a great win for our patients and quite frankly for our facilities, particularly as we have gone through this last surge. So what about staffing and particularly the nursing care? As I explained earlier, prior to COVID, we were challenged with regards to our nursing and quite frankly, all of our clinical care within healthcare. But with the COVID crisis, there came multiple opportunities. A lot of nurses either left nursing altogether, they left the bedside, or they went to become traveling nurses because they were getting upwards of $10,000 a week to go travel and become a nurse in hotspots around the country. So 79% of our nursing job postings today are currently being filled with agency nursing staff. I will tell you that this is really one of the great existential threats to our ability to continue to deliver healthcare. This is not sustainable. It limits consistency. It limits our mentoring capability. It limits team building. And it limits a lot of the things that we have done to improve the quality of care that we provide. One of the items that we've done initially is we started at the early onset of surges to actually go and do stretch nursing, where typically there may have been a 1-to-2 or a 1-to-3 nurse to patient ratio. Those nurses would then take an extra one or two patients. It became very apparent as our nursing supply dwindled and we were unable to hire that we needed to think innovatively about how we're going to care for the patients within our system. And we went from an expanded or a stretch nursing to what we've now called a team nursing. And what this allowed is one nurse, rather than to have 1-to-2 or 1-to-3 patients, we would surround this experienced nurse with other healthcare professionals. They may be nurses, but for example, they may be OR nurses. During the heavy surges in January and in this last surge in August, we turned down our surgical engine because we needed to deploy or redeploy our nursing staff elsewhere to help care for the patients we had. And this was really very successful because that nurse now became the manager of a team of other nurses, as well as other people that could talk to patients, walk patients. They could check on their IVs and let the nurse know if IVs needed to be changed. We've taken this one step further and are now looking at ways to actually do a virtual nursing or a virtual integrated model where we could have one of these experienced nurses in a virtual platform actually in monitoring multiple units in order that we can adequately cover with nursing staff that's experienced and quite frankly knows what needs to get done moving forward. There's lots of metrics that we could think about But I would tell you that one of the key things moving forward that we're going to need to be innovative on is our staffing models. I don't see us in the near future going back to a staffing model pre-pandemic, because I don't think we'll have the nursing staff left. And there's lots of things that we can do that I'll get to at the end of this presentation. Next. Finally, on the supply side, we did think about what resources and tools do we have to combat surges. We've very quickly, when monoclonal antibodies became available, we very quickly converted pre-existing infusion centers into monoclonal antibody infusion centers. As I said earlier, one of the things that we really were challenged with early on was our ability to test. Nobody had the reagents. We went and we got multiple platforms, multiple reagents. We very quickly got into screening, and also were the first in the state in our area to provide vaccines, not only to our healthcare workforce, but to our community through outreaches, through centers that we put up at the Orlando International Airport. And certainly from a supply chain standpoint, we knew that telehealth was going to be important with regards to how do we care for people and how do we connect families with patients, particularly patients who are COVID positive in ICUs. And we very quickly expanded our telehealth capabilities, largely due to some of the relief we got from the legislature with regards to the previous restrictions. So what have we seen just from an innovative standpoint in supplies? We have currently treated about 6,000 patients, AdventHealth has, 6,000 patients with monoclonal antibody infusions. If you take a conservative number of 10% of patients who receive antibody infusions, you save on readmissions or admissions to the hospital. We would tell you that we believe conservatively, just by us giving those antibody infusions, we were able to reduce admissions by about 600. Within our AdventHealth CentraCare, which is our urgent cares throughout the I-4 corridor, we have done about 435,000 COVID-19 tests. As a Central Florida division, we have now accomplished 1.4 million tests. As a West division, they've done 350,000 tests. We have screened more than 30,000 travelers at the Orlando International Airport. We've provided community partners and municipalities 40,000 tests. And I think one of the things I'm most proud about AdventHealth is our ability to vaccinate our community, where we have done 62,000 vaccines administered across the AdventHealth Central Florida division. So kudos to this institution that I believe was at the forefront of what we needed to do to try to get to come to grips with the pandemic. So looking beyond, So we are now building on our innovation in response to COVID with three additional pathways similar to what you saw with that remote patient monitoring through Vivify. We've got a program which we've now called Delta Force, where we are in the process of expanding our ability to remotely monitor patients who have pneumonia, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and asthma. These are three diagnoses that have high visits to EDs, and they have high readmission rates as well. Again, we've talked about the workforce shortage issue, and I would say that collaboration between policymakers and healthcare professionals is really crucial with regards to our ability to make sure that we have an adequate workforce moving forward. We believe we need more students, we need more professors, we need more seats, but we also need to think about ways that we're going to innovate for our nursing workforce. I will tell you, I don't know of a single nurse that went to nursing school because they love documenting things in an electronic medical record. The sad reality today is that 40% of a nurse's time is spent documenting. One of the things that we've learned through this crisis is that when nurses go to crisis documentation, which is documentation that's less repetitive and less frequent, there is no decrement in the care that they provide. I would ask us collectively to start looking at things like, what does a nurse have to document, and work with our partners at CMS and ACA, as well as the DNV, so that we can better elaborate and make sure that we know what is necessary for nurses to document and when. We need continued regulatory flexibility with regards to telehealth. We've clearly understood the benefits of this. And I believe one of the great things that's going to face us as a healthcare industry is the behavioral health needs that is going to result as a result of our COVID. And this is not only in our community, but it's also within our healthcare workers. So I do believe that telehealth is going to be an important function moving forward. And I would look to this committee to help us go figure out how do we do telehealth in a comprehensive, cohesive fashion that improves the quality of life for both the patients as well as our caregiver. The last piece that I would just throw out for something for the committee to think about is that COVID made visible the chasm in our public health infrastructure, not only in the state of Florida, but I would claim nationwide. People suffered. We didn't communicate immediately through a secure network. We couldn't share real-time data. We couldn't share real-time data with diverse providers. I couldn't share new protocols. I couldn't share checklists. I had no situational awareness of available resources immediately when they were needed. Whether those resources were ventilators, whether they were ICU beds, or whether they were ECMO beds. Our state's public health systems were not designed to communicate, coordinate, and they have no mobile platform. So I do believe that that it's time for us to consider systems and engineering approach to design a public health system to respond to crises. This would include defining key capabilities and data needs, as well as integrating solutions to build a much needed response network for the state of Florida. If we're able to do this and use a system engineering approach and integrate multiple technologies, the state of Florida can prevent deaths, we can prevent disability, we can prevent suffering, we could reduce costs, and quite frankly, I believe we can and should be a model for the country on how the public and private sectors can come together to address the most pressing problems for COVID as well as other future events. Thank you for your time, Madam Chairman, and I am happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Finkler. Members, do we have any questions? Representative Tant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious as to any barriers on the telemedicine front, I mean, in terms of insurance coverage or any other issues with that.
You're recognized, Doctor.
Thank you. So that's a great question. So prior to COVID, the answer was yes. I think the limiting factor, in fact, in telehealth were all the restrictions, many of them payment restrictions. But with the advent of COVID, those restrictions were lifted. The ability to actually do telehealth even across state lines got improved. So I do believe that we are in a better situation today than we were. But, again, we've utilized telehealth mostly within our acute care walls. And now as we start thinking about the ability to expand outside the acute care walls, care at home that I know my Mayo friends are going to speak about, I think the telehealth platforms become really critically important. And if you start thinking about all the behavioral health needs that we see today, and we will continue to see for years to come as a result of this crisis, I think it's important that we all collectively keep an eye on the regulatory features and make sure this is as easy as possible to implement.
Additional questions? Anybody with an additional question? Okay, I have a question. I don't normally ask questions, but I do today. When you mentioned this remote patient monitoring and the interface, I'm sorry, I don't remember what that was called, and also the partnership with Dispatch Health, were these, the software, for example, for the remote patient monitoring, is that something that was designed, developed since the beginning of the pandemic, or was that something that was perhaps available in the field, just not widely utilized previously? Doctor.
Yeah, so I'm sorry. Yeah, great question as well. So these were things that were developed but not quite well utilized. And the remote patient monitoring platform that we use is a company called Vivify. And the Dispatch Health is actually the home care company that will go to their home with individuals to check up on them. Two different platforms, but the Vivify, the remote patient monitoring, what happens is that the patient actually gets the device, gets thermometers, as well as pulse oximeter. That gets monitored through a central station through Vivify. They then notify based on algorithms that we have. They'll notify our provider. Our provider will then pick the phone up or do a televisit, and if needed, go out to the facility to see the patient. So that's physically how that worked.
Anybody else have a question before I ask another? Thank you. Representative Duran, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Doctor, for being here virtually. I had a question on this, actually, the remote patient care monitoring, and just curious in how, say you have a patient presents at Advent, but then they also have a relationship with a care, wellness and comprehensive care sort of facility. You know, you have a lot of the smaller ones that are out there that provide that sort of comprehensive care and wellness. Is this data, how does this interact with that facility? Do you share that data in some way, or how does that go along?
You're recognized, Dr. Finkler.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So as long as we know that there's that other facility, we would share that data with that facility. But I think one of the challenges in healthcare is that we remain quite fragmented. And oftentimes we don't know that information. But again, if we know it, we share that information and we let that provider know that the patient is at home with remote patient monitor, they're COVID positive, this is what we're doing. And if there are issues, we would alert them as well.
Additional questions? Just for clarification, Dr. Finkler, I would assume that would be perhaps a patient's primary care physician as well, would fall into that category of whom you would share with, am I correct?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Davis, you recognized for question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Doctor, for being here. The screen shows us you're mentioning the workforce shortage issue. Being policymakers and partnering with our healthcare professionals, what are some of your suggestions as to how we can partner and collaborate to end the shortage issue?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So I do believe we need to expand the number of seats available within our nursing schools. And one of the big reasons why nursing seats are as limited as they are is the fact that they can't attract professors. So I think we need to think about what does that salary structure have to look like for those that are going to teach the next generation of nurses that, quite frankly, are going to take care of all of us. And I think those are some of the easier wins. The other big win is just to think about how do we make nursing more attractive in general. I think a team approach is really important. The vast majority of our workforce today has under 2 years of experience. And I think that speaks for the fact that they don't have that seasoned, experienced nurse. So when we have them, we have to utilize them in a very different fashion. I think a tele or a virtual approach is actually a smart, very clever way to utilize these very seasoned nurses that will be able to watch the junior nurses and be able to help them along on their pathway. And they could do that on multiple different floors, as opposed to today, where we think of having that seasoned nurse on one floor overlooking maybe 20 beds. The reality is that we don't have that luxury today to have that many seasoned nurses. So we're going to have to think very differently about what it looks like. We have to improve the numbers that are in the workforce, and we have to make it a far more attractive profession with regards to what's their work schedule like. Again, most people go into nursing because they want to be at the bedside. They don't want to be a computer documenting. And I do think this is an opportunity for us. You know, as one of my great professors taught me, never let a crisis go to waste. Let's look at what the nurses do today with regards to the need for documentation. This will take interaction with our legislative as well as our regulatory bodies, including CMS, J-Code, DNB. But I think it's time that we address this to do whatever we can do to make this an attractive profession moving forward.
Thank you. Additional questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Finkler, for your time today and for taking putting so much work into the presentation, answering our questions. This is great information. Next, we will hear from A.J. Dunn. Mr. Dunn is the Mayo Clinic Chair of Advanced Care at Home Digital Practice Strategy and the Assistant Professor of Healthcare Systems Engineering at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and Science. Welcome, Mr. Dunn. You are recognized.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and also to Dr. Finkler for outlining the content so elegantly. Can the team hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Wonderful. Well, so I'm excited to join the group to talk about Advanced Care at Home, which is an initiative that looks to take hospital-level care for really highly acute, highly sick patients that would have been delivered in our brick-and-mortar facilities and to take that to the home. We started this process prior to the COVID pandemic as a major initiative across all of Mayo Clinic, but starting and home-based at the Mayo Clinic in Florida. And so I'll walk through a little bit of our experience and then look forward to your questions. So previous to my assignment leading the enterprise digital strategy, I was the administrator for a brick and mortar hospital for several years in Florida. And as we think about the hospital, particularly in the time of COVID, we see patients concerned about not being able to see their family members. They're not always enamored with the food, being stuck in bed. We have all sorts of blips and beats in the middle of the night that at times interrupt patients' sleep. And though I'm really proud of the care that we delivered in our brick and mortar hospital, when you look at it through this lens, the hospital isn't a great place to be. And in fact, as we look at some of the data coming out of a study that was done at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona, what they saw was a resemblance between being in the hospital and enhanced interrogation. So in enhanced interrogation, you take people and you strip them of their clothes and their individuality, you put them in uniforms. You restrict their movement, you isolate them, you sleep deprive them. Many of those things sound very familiar in terms of a hospital stay. So home hospitalization has been around for quite some time. In 1997, there was a team at Johns Hopkins that really pioneered a model of delivering high acuity hospital care in the home. Lots of different groups have been doing low acuity care to deflect low acuity admissions to eliminate some of the one night observation stays. But when we look at truly the sick patient that one would imagine being in a medical or surgical unit, in 1997, there has been a fair amount of work done all the way up through 2020 when we launched our program in July. There have been a number of different reviews looking at safety, looking at cost, patient experience, and universally, they all basically say the same thing. The model is technically feasible, but the lack of payment models and the lack of regulatory environment has prevented for many, many years any of these models from going beyond these niche proof of concepts to something that truly can actually scale and start to make a difference across the healthcare landscape. And as we look at this moment where hopefully we're coming out of this global pandemic and lots of different people have started to innovate to potentially see if we're in a position where we can actually start to change the landscape. So I'll walk through the model really briefly and then look forward to your questions. So the primary assumption around hospital at home is that in the traditional care delivery setting, patients who get sick enough to need hospital care leave the comfort, convenience, and the personal control of their lives when they're at home and they go to a traditional hospital. And they do so because hospitals house the expertise, the technology, the care delivery models. We have over time consolidated because of economic advantages. All of these high-cost therapies in these individual buildings, and people come from all over to those buildings. The problem is there's a trade-off involved. You have to leave that comfort and convenience to get that expertise. Mayo Clinic's Advanced Care at Home model tries to reverse that and eliminate the trade-off by taking care to the patient so you get both the comfort, convenience, and control, and also the expertise and capability of a high-quality hospital system. That's really the value proposition from the patient's perspective. And as we take a step back and as we look at this from a system perspective, the goal is also to create capacity. We believe at full maturity, which is likely 2 to 3 years away, we can take 1 in 4, so 25% of the patient days that are currently spent in our brick and mortar hospital, we can remove those patient days, creating capacity to backfill. We can drive affordability because by moving away from the expense of a brick and mortar facility, we can significantly lower cost. And we can also expand our reach. There are a number of patients for whom travel to our facilities isn't feasible. They can't afford it. And so if we can figure out a way to go to the patient and meet the patient where they are, we believe we can expand our reach. And we do so using four basic components. The first is what we call our tech stack. So we've got a technology bundle that we put in each patient's home to help us replicate the capabilities of monitoring the patient. So we have Bluetooth-enabled pulse oximeters, scales, blood pressure cuffs, et cetera. We have backup internet capabilities. So we have a system that we can install. So if the patient's internet fails, we are able to pull off of a cell tower nearby from multiple different vendors, such that we don't have an acutely ill patient in the home who's in distress without our knowledge because the patient's internet failed. All of these devices are connected to backup power. So we have a remote mobile backup power unit. So if the patient's power fails, we have redundancy and resiliency in the system. We have an internet connected phone. We call it our bat phone, that you pick up the phone and it rings directly into our command center. So you don't need to dial any numbers. There's just a direct line in. We also have an iPad tablet that's really the center of the system. It collects all of the Bluetooth data and pushes it to us. And so the tech stack really goes way far into the process of setting up all of the capabilities to monitor and communicate with high reliability and resilience. That, as you can imagine, is spitting out lots of data in real time about the patient's cardiac, pulmonary, all sorts of different conditions. And we have synthesized all of that data using a software platform. What we don't want is a team hearing a beep in our command center every single time the patient's respiratory rate increases or decreases. So we collect and synthesize all of that data and then use a software platform to figure out what's the meaningful signal amongst the whole host of noise that's coming back in so that we can push actionable data to our teams. This also takes our traditional medical record system, which we happen to use Epic, and it equips that Epic medical record system to do more than it's normally designed to do. So that's the second component. The third component is a medical operations command center. So we have a 24/7 medical operations command center that has physicians, advanced practice providers like nurse practitioners and physician assistants. We have nurses, pharmacists, case managers, and the like. All of the people that you would see bustling about a typical hospital, the only thing that's missing is the patient, because the patient's in a medical ward. That ward, though, happens to be in their home. But we co-locate the entire team, and they round on the patients every day virtually. They communicate with the patients. They make medical decisions and plans. And those plans are enacted in the home using a supplier network. So what you see here is listed a network of 18 different services that we call our supplier network, with the first box having community paramedicine and acute rapid response, all of which are able to go into and out of the home in rapid order to replicate all of the capabilities of a typical patient in a medical facility. So if our physician interacts with the patient and that patient is in distress and we need to have an infusion of a critical medicine, we have a pharmacy in the local area compound a medicine. We have a durable medical equipment provider place a pump in the home. We have a home health agency deploy a nurse. We have that nurse deploy the medicine to the patient, and we have an advanced practice provider assess the patient's physical status. And all of that happens in a highly synchronized and orchestrated way, where we have contracts with not just one or two, but three or more providers in each of those different service areas. So if it's Super Bowl Sunday and it's 10 o'clock at night and we need a service to be performed, we have a guarantee with a service level agreement that we'll be able to get into and out of that home with high reliability. So we are orchestrating care across three different settings. First is on our campus, where we have the Medical Operations Command Center at the Jacksonville campus. It's about 10 minutes that way. That command center coordinates the care in the community. So in and around the patient's home is the community, and then in the patient's home where we have the technology. The community is usually between a 25 to a 35 mile radius, because we need significant density. We can't have a patient in Daytona Beach and the team is being dispatched from Amelia Island. We have to be able to get into and out of the home, because we're not delivering home health care. We're delivering hospital level care for acutely ill patients. And so the service response times that we've orchestrated and calibrated really is very significant. But the difference and the distance between the command center and each supplier network is unlimited. So today we're managing patients in home hospital beds in Jacksonville, Florida, in Northwest Wisconsin, in Phoenix, Arizona, and we're having conversations about how this Florida-based command center can essentially be a hub for care delivered across the nation. So patients get into the program one of two ways. First, they could show up in our emergency department and go directly home in a process that we call hospital substitution. So we substitute for the entirety of the hospital stay. There are other patients that may show up. They go to the brick and mortar hospital. They're in a hospital bed sometimes for a day or two of what might have been a 6-day episode of care. But after the first day, everything is stabilized. We've run all of the more expensive high-level tests that are difficult to take on the road. Then we can have the rest of that hospitalization. So we call that reduced length of stay. And that's where, if you keep in mind, what we've said is at full maturity, we should be able to take 1 in 4 patient days out of the brick and mortar hospital. These are the two pathways, eliminating it altogether or reducing that stay. We have two phases. First is our acute phase. The acute phase represents the time the patient would have spent in the traditional brick and mortar hospital. On average, that's about 4 days. Inpatient, high level use of nursing and therapies, frequent visits, lots of diagnostics. And again, that's replacing time the patient would have spent in the traditional hospital. In the traditional hospital, there is production pressure, though, to get the patient well enough to go home. And we typically do 100% of the medical care for patients when they're in the hospital. We're telling the patient what medicine to take, at what time, we're administering the medicine. We're making all of the decisions when the patient is in our hospital. And then they're discharged, and that typically often will go from 100% of the care down to zero. And so there's this really big drop-off, because that bed is precious and we need to get the next patient into that bed and the cycle repeats. In this model, the production pressure for the bed doesn't exist. And once we've already installed the tech, we have the command center built, the cost of the 6th and the 7th and the 8th day is actually relatively little. And so what we've been able to do is to build a model with both an acute phase and a restorative phase. So now, as the patient is walking through their continuum of care, we walk with them through that full journey, and we do significantly more coaching, education, transition care. And so that patient who's discharged on Wednesday and has a video visit on Thursday, and we see the patient's spouse in the background mixing up a large jug of Kool-Aid, we can ask, who's that Kool-Aid for? Because this is a patient that has congestive heart failure, and if we're not adjusting and managing those medications to adjust for the fact that they're having large amounts of Kool-Aid, but you can actually live with the patient in their home and understand how it is that they live with their disease, coach them to manage as best we can, and then also make adjustments based on how we understand the patient lives. In the hospital, we don't see any of that, and so it's really hard to customize the patient's care journey to how it is they will actually live with their disease in the real world. So some very quick statistics. Our average daily census right now is about 39 to 40 patients. We started this year with about a census of 6 patients, and last year in July, we launched with a census of 2 patients. So we're expanding the program as we go. We've served over 900 patients and saved over 2,000 bed days, which for us has been critical as we've seen the surge of Delta variant accelerated COVID. Our quality outcomes. One of the things we do is we look at severity of illness. So that's a 1 to 4 scale, where 1 is a patient with mild disease, 4 is a patient with catastrophic disease, thinking of a patient in the ICU, and a 3 is a patient with major disease. In our brick and mortar, our average SOI, or severity of illness, is 2.6. In ACH, it's higher, it's 2.8. So that just underscores the fact that these truly are very sick patients. This isn't, you know, modified home health. Our mortality rates in our brick and mortar hospital, we're incredibly proud of. It is nation leading. It's, if you look at a raw number, it's less than 0.5%. If you look at an observed to expected rate, it's a little bit different. We've had 0 mortality with a higher illness population in this program. Our readmissions are about 1/3 of the brick and mortar hospital. Our brick and mortar hospital, I'm incredibly proud of, has about an 89% likelihood to recommend a top box score. You ask a patient on a 1 to 5 scale, what's your likelihood of recommending? If they give you a 5, very likely, it counts. If you give it a 4, likely it doesn't count. 89% in our brick and mortar in ACH, it's 95%. And the other 5% is 4s, patients who say likely, but just not very likely. Medication errors, we look at as well, and being fully transparent, we have 4.6 medication errors per 1,000 patient days in our brick and mortar hospital. At ACH, we're 6.5. At the beginning of this year, we were about 12, we were down to 8, and now we're about to 6.5. So we continue to refine the model, and our goal is to chase 0 as close as we can. Falls, we're about the same in terms of falls per 1,000 patient days. And the impact for patients has been incredible. We've had patients who have both been ill with COVID, who would have been on different units, not able to see them, and we're able to take care of both of them in the home. We've had patients who care for children with disabilities, single parents with children with disabilities who would have been admitted to the hospital and would have been away from their family members in a way that would have been really challenging, and we've been able to take care of them in the home. We've had a patient undergo bone marrow transplantation that would have been a 17 to 18 day episode of care. They spent 3 days in the hospital and all of the remaining time was spent at home, meaning they were with and around their loved ones during probably the most difficult time of their lives, as opposed to being in a sterile place with a caring team, but it's just not the same as home. So I mentioned the technology, the command center, the software platform, and the supplier network. The other piece we need for every patient population we see is to calibrate the model, to run simulations, to test with one patient and then scale. So we need to calibrate the model for every single disease. A kidney transplant patient has different needs than a patient with, again, bone marrow transplant. The payment model doesn't exist nationally. So we're involved in hand-to-hand combat from payer to payer to payer to talk about how we can get funding for this model. And then the regulatory framework, everything that we do in this model sits many, many, many years ahead of the legislation that sits on the books. And so we're spending a lot of time with various groups trying to get them on board with a model that they understand, they agree with, but it's just the regulations don't align with the way that we're delivering care. So we often quote our founding fathers, the Mayo brothers. They talk about the best interest of the patient is the only to be considered. And so that really drives our primary value, which is the needs of the patient come first. The second half, though, is that in order that the sick may have the benefit of advancing knowledge, a union of forces is necessary. They recognized early on that we can do very little by ourselves. And so as Mayo Clinic, we really are looking forward to partnering with the legislature, with the regulators, with payers and others, to really help to create a place where this care model can expand. With that, thank you for the time, and I will hopefully bring this presentation down.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Members, do we have any questions? Representative Duran, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this has been a stimulating conversation today. And thank you, Mr. Dunn, for being here. So I wanted to kind of dive into this a little bit more. You know, the idea that we are shifting into more of a value-based care healthcare system as opposed to fee-for-service, where you have a lot of preventative care, you have a lot of thinking about leveraging technology and utilizing the data to maintain and keep people healthy and keep them out of the most expensive healthcare settings vis-a-vis the hospital or an ER room. When I look at how you're presenting what you're presenting here, it feels like what the hospital is looking to do is pivot outside of the delivery of emergency medicine, the delivery of complex surgeries, and more involved in the overarching overall health of that patient. Or are we just talking? And I think I heard you say at the beginning, I may be confused, but is this for a specific subset of patients who tend to be more sick and living with exacerbated chronic conditions?
You're recognized, Mr. Dunn.
So, well, thank you very much for the question. The way I would say it is we've calibrated the model to care for the most sick patients we have in the hospital that are not in the ICU, that don't require ICU level care, knowing that there's a large continuum of care for which we could actually start to provide care for patients with chronic conditions, patients that need ED care, urgent care visits. There's a full continuum of care that we intend to build out, but we thought it made sense to start with most the sickest patient in the hospital and think about how we build a care model with the same team using virtual care to manage their entire episode of care. Because what we often see is a patient in the hospital, they leave and they go to a skilled nursing facility, they leave and they potentially go to the ED or an urgent care center and they get readmitted. And so they're bouncing back and forth between several different care teams, lacking coordination of care because there isn't a model that funds the coordination of care across the acute and post-acute setting. We've been working with commercial insurers to create 30-day bundles that allow us to manage that patient's care over a 30-day episode of care, where we take accountability for that entire episode of care in a model that we think may be better. So it really is focused on hospital-based care, but we think we can expand the model over time to a broader patient population.
You have follow-up, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that, Mr. Dunn. So when you say that, I guess, you know, part of kind of my understanding of value-based care is you get the incentive is in keeping someone healthy. The incentive is from keeping them into costly care scenarios. And if you can save that, the funding that those providers are able to capitalize on what they're able to save there. With respect to this, is there a different sort of billing or a different sort of economics to this delivery of care than as, it, you know, so I guess, do you bill differently on this kind of setting as opposed to when someone comes into the hospital and is there for an emergency sort of situation?
You're recognized, Mr. Dunn.
For our government-insured patients, we're billing the same way. So we're actually delivering 30 days of care, but we're actually billing in the traditional model that intends to care for was often a 5 to 6 day episode of care. And so we are underperforming financially because we think it's the right model of care to develop. With our commercially insured partners, we're looking to try to build custom 30-day models that actually provides a payment for 30 days that generates value where the patient pays less, the insurer pays less, and hopefully the provider has some incentive to be able to keep the patient well and not utilizing high-cost care models. And so we've taken a bifurcated approach, but it's a model that we've not engaged in based on a profit motive, certainly as a nonprofit system, but really as an investment in where we think care needs to go in the future. And so we're working in a model for which there isn't appropriate reimbursement just because we think someone has to do it, and why not us?
Thank you. Representative Soroy, you're recognized. You're good. Representative Masullo, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you again, Mr. Dunn, for your presentation. It seems that the system that you've proposed and have put in place works quite well in your particular facility. And I see where the cost savings would be, particularly for your facility. But I also see the model being more expensive for delivery of care for the supplier network, as opposed to having those individuals right there by the bedside or close to the bedside on the same floor. Have you done any cost analysis vis-a-vis those type data points in putting together that entire package? Because now you have a patient that you're extending, if we're saying they're going to spend a week in hospital and as opposed to 30 days in in-home care, with all those additional costs from the supplier network of those people that aren't geographically close and having to bring in equipment, supplies, et cetera, into the home, with ever different restrictions, everyone has different living spaces, et cetera. Have you looked at that and where you'd have to scale to have that be economically feasible as far as delivering adequate and efficient care?
You recognize, Mr. Dunn.
Thank you for the question. We have worked with a team from the Harvard Business School. There's a professor there, Dr. Robert Kaplan, who pioneered a model called time-driven activity-based costing. And we've used that model to compare cost of the brick and mortar facility and advanced care at home. And thus far, in our first 6 months of launch, we've identified that this model can be 5% less expensive than the traditional model of care. And in our traditional period of launch, that first 6 months, our sole focus was safety and patient experience. And so there were a whole host of system inefficiencies where we were using belt and suspenders just to ensure that as we launched, we were safer. Over the last 6 to 9 months, we've been working on efficiencies. And so we plan to repeat that study, knowing that if in our period of time when we were not at all focused on efficiencies, we were 5% less, if we redo that study now, we should at least be 15 to 20% less. And the reason is, if we take out all of the overhead cost of being in a physical brick and mortar hospital by putting the patient in their home where we're not paying for a bed, the utilities, all of those services, the overhead is significantly lower. But the cost to get a service out to the home to draw a vial of blood in our hospital is extremely low cost. To draw a vial of blood in the home costs significantly more because we're dispatching someone to the home. The difference, however, is that we found our utilization rates in the home have tended to be lower. So we are paying more per service, but we're actually using fewer services in how we coordinate care in the home. So the overall cost of care has been lower. We think we get to a break even once we get to a census of around 100 to 120 patients. And right now we're running a census of about 39 to 40 patients. So we're in the ramp up phase where we're operating not to our financial advantage. But again, we see that once we're at about 100 patients, that's when we get to break even.
Representative Masullo, you're recognized for follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just briefly, have you changed any of your protocols for in-home care to be able to get to those decision points where your utilization isn't quite as high?
You recognize, Mr. Dunn?
No. We've not changed any of our protocols. What we find is, and this isn't ideal, we try to be good stewards in all of our settings of care, but in the brick and mortar hospital, it really is very easy to say, let's order a repeat lab on this or repeat this on that. And so the ability to order additional tests and services is really quite there. And so if you have any potential interest, then you're able to do so. In the home setting, you actually have to roll a vehicle to the home. And so you really pause to think, do we absolutely need this service? And many times our physicians can diagnose things simply by interacting with the patient. And so we haven't changed any protocols. We've not rationed any care. But what we find is when you have to send someone to the home, you think twice about everything that you order, and our utilization rate has fallen as a result.
Additional questions? Representative Yarbrough, you recognize?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, gentlemen, for the informative presentations today about what your systems are doing and where you'd like to go. We appreciate that. My question through the chair would be, if we implement some of these changes that you've described and continue moving forward, where would you expect to be in, you know, say 5 years from now? I know it's hard to estimate, and we have a lot of, you know, changes right now that we didn't even foresee we'd be working on maybe 2 or 3 years ago. But if you had to opine on that, where would you say that we might be in about 5 years or so? Thank you, Madam Chair.
You recognize, Mr. Dunn.
Thank you for the question. I would envision that we would have significantly more care being rendered in the home at much greater convenience and at lower system level cost. I also envision, to make the model work, just as Dr. Finkler described, we'll actually need to be creative about creating the workforce of the future. We simply don't have enough staff to be able to go into homes and deliver this care. And so whether it's thinking creatively about how we use community paramedics and other resources, I think there is a workforce that doesn't exist today that we'll need to build for these new and more innovative models of care. The other thing I would say is we'll need to create what I believe is somewhat of an innovation sandbox, where we're able to actually take new models of care and thread the needle between innovating and coming up with new concepts, and also keeping the patient safe and preventing fraud and abuse. Much of the regulatory environment exists because we need to prevent fraud and abuse, but what it does is it takes things that we could do to deliver care to patients to improve their experience and to lower cost, and it takes them off the table because there's a regulation that says we can do this or we can't do that, where we know if we're given an opportunity to innovate with new technology that didn't exist when the regulations were written, we would be able to do things that would be good for the system. And so thinking about how we create a small space for experimentation with guardrails before we scale broadly, I think is something that we need to think about, because in the absence of that, I think we will see the pace of innovation slow in the absence of public-private partnerships to create these innovation sandboxes.
Additional questions? I have a question, if I could. Mr. Dunn, you mentioned regulatory constraints. Can you give us a little more specific examples on that? Are we talking, you know, Medicare federal regulation, state level regulation?
Thank you. We currently operate the home hospital in Wisconsin, in Arizona, and in Florida. And in each state, we have different guidelines about scope of practice for each of the different members of the team. And in each state, we've had to navigate different approaches to being able to make things work. During the state of emergency that we appreciated that was passed in the state at the beginning of the COVID pandemic in the state of Florida, we were able to use our hospital-based pharmacy to administer medications to patients, whether they were in the hospital or at home, using our own internal guidance on what was safe to be able to drive that. With the state of emergency gone, we can probably take 3 or 4 patients at home per day in terms of admissions, where in the past we were able to admit about 6 to 8 patients, because now we're using outside pharmacies because our own internal pharmacy has a set of regulations reimposed back on it, and we lack the ability to take the hospital-based pharmacy and administer hospital-based drugs to a patient at home. Because the idea is a hospital is defined as a building, whereas we view the hospital as a level of care that is now building agnostic, because we're able to deliver the same level of care in the home. And so those are some of the things that we face, is inability to use our pharmacy in the way that we'd like. In the past, the use of paramedics had been defined in a very specific scope. That scope never contemplated a digitally enabled platform solution for home hospitalization when those requirements were written. And so today we're using folks to deliver the physician who are sitting in the actually monitoring the patient and giving direction, but that doesn't align with the traditional model of the use of a community paramedic. And so there are all of these examples where the digital capabilities that we've been able to bring to the table enable new things to be done, but those new things are not defined in rules that were often written 20 years ago. Secretary Marsteller visited our campus recently from the Agency for Healthcare Administration, and they have been a wonderful partner. And she has said she stands ready with her team to partner with us to think creatively about ways to unlock some of these opportunities and also still keep the residents and citizens of Florida safe.
Thank you. Representative Grant, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for your presentation today. I'm curious, it seems to me that we have a workforce shortage, not just in the state of Florida, but across the country, probably across the developed world. And as our population ages and we have less people coming into the workforce, similar to what happened in Japan and Western Europe, are you aware of any other countries that are looking at this model or a different way of providing hospital-type care in the home that you're basing your models on? And if so, what has been the experience of those other countries?
You're recognized, Mr. Dunn.
In Australia and across much of the Scandinavian countries, these models do exist. And the reason they exist is because our model for payment of healthcare is different. So they have more socialized single-payer systems. And even if the providers are private providers, the payer is a single payer. And that enables them to bypass what has been many of the challenges that we've faced. And so, yes, the models have worked well. It's been well described. There have been some really exceptional papers in the Australian system. I'm not saying I want to see our private employer-based system change. But what I would say is that we need to think creatively about models. And one of the things that we plan to do is to work with CMMI, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, to pitch to the federal government in partnership with a consortium of other healthcare organizations in this space, including Kaiser Permanente and others, some models that we think would be great demonstration projects that we could run. And with that CMMI approval, I think that's one of the first steps that we can take to be able to unlock opportunities. And if that were to come to pass, it would also require partnering with local state leaders to be able to ensure that the scope of practice, things that we talked about, the pharmacy challenges, that we could solve those such that we could be, within the state of Florida, a national demonstration model. And personally, as someone who's lived in Florida essentially all of my life, I'd love to be able to say, Florida's the group that can fix this.
Thank you. Members, any additional questions? Any addition? We have Dr. Finkler with us as well, so if you've thought of something since his presentation, I'm sure he'd be happy to answer. Okay, seeing none, Dr. Finkler and Mr. Dunn, we cannot thank you enough for your time today. I have a feeling, knowing the members of this committee, that they're already starting to set something, think of some ways that we could help implement better care for patients all across Florida. Thank you very much for your time, members. Thank you, as always, for your great, thoughtful questions and attention to the details of our presentation today. I think this is a great way to kick off it's a positive way, I want to say, to kick off this session with some, I want everybody's, you know, your wheels to start turning now on how we can certainly work together to provide better access for patients all across the state of Florida. And the examples both of these gentlemen gave us are certainly how that can begin to happen, perhaps for more patients in Florida. And that concludes our committee agenda, and Representative Davis moves we rise. So without objection, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.